Matthew Frye, asking this court to direct the Honorable William Harris to set aside an order which he signed on May the 28th, 2007, which declared void an order of enforcement for payment of child support and arrearage that was dated July 28th, 1999. And on July 28th, 1999, the 254th Court in Dallas County signed an order for the payment of child support. Matthew Frye was the respondent on that case, and he signed the order of the court, as did the real party in interest in this case, Stacy Kaler. That order directed Mr. Frye to make certain payments on his arrearage over the course of the next several years until that arrearage was paid in full. 9 years later, the real party in interest, Stacy Kaler, petitioned the court after the case was transferred to Tarrant County, the 233rd Court, to set aside that order on the basis that there was an order of dismissal signed 2 days before, on July 26, 1999, which dismissed the case. Therefore, it would render the July 28th order void.
The motion to set aside the judgment of July 28, 1999, as void, I don't believe is in our appendix of documents. Exactly what was being sought, by whom, how did the case get before the Tarrant County Court? What was the purpose?
My understanding is that the suit was actually brought by the Attorney General's office on behalf of mother, to collect arrearage on child support. And apparently at the hearing, the mother was under the impression she was represented by the Attorney General's office, as that is reflected in the order of July 28, 1999. Although there may be some mistake on who represented who, it was clear from the order that the Attorney General actually appeared, as did the real parties in interest, and the real parties in interest approved the eventually approved the order signed by the court. But I believe that the actual motion was brought by the Attorney General's office. That's how it got before the court.
Okay.
The position of relator on this case is simply this, that Middleton versus Murph, which is a Texas Supreme Court case, Texas 1985, says that even if an order is void or voidable, that if that order was not challenged within the plenary power of the court or brought or challenged by a bill of review, that order cannot be set aside, cannot be touched, that no longer does the court have power to set aside that judgment, whether or not it's void or voidable. And that is very clear in the Middleton versus Murph. And the respondent's position on this case is that, in fact, the July 28, 1999 order was void. Well, what Middleton versus Murph stands for is it doesn't matter whether it was void or not. Now, in the alternative, we have argued that that the July 28th order was actually a modification of the order of dismissal from 2 days before. And in support of that position, we have cited several cases, and those cases include Corning Fiberglass versus Wozniak and Quainame versus Frasco Restaurant and Catering. In those cases, it should be pointed out that the second order was challenged within the plenary power of the court. So these cases that are either cited by the relator or by the real party in interest that deal with orders on whether or not to vacate, reform, or modify, every one of them was challenged during the plenary power of the court. And what sets this case apart is that that is not the case in this case. The July 28, 1990 order, 1999 order was never challenged during the plenary power of the court. Nonetheless, the Owens Corning fiberglass case went on to hold that any change in a judgment during the trial court's period of plenary power should be treated as a modified, corrected, or reformed judgment that presumptively vacates the trial court's former judgment unless the record indicates a contrary intent. Now, prior to that, in 1980, I believe there was a case that's been cited by the respondent, the McCormick case, which held basically just the opposite. It said that we're not going to presume intent by the court unless there's an express language to vacate in the second order. The Owens Corning fiberglass case, as well as the Quainham case, go on at great length to discuss the intent of the Supreme Court and how the law has evolved due to the language in 329BH, which says that in any instance, the language in any instance, that in any time an order is modified in any instance, that language coupled with the holding in the Check versus Mitchell case, and that holding was that if a judgment is modified or changed in any respect, the time for appeal will run from the modified judgment. And so it doesn't matter how the order is changed, it doesn't matter how the order is modified, if there's been any change at all, that the timetable start to run again, and the second order will control. It is the contention of relator in this case that due to the fact that the second order was signed 2 days after the first order, that in and of itself shows an intent by the court to change and modify their judgment, their first judgment. But the case law says we don't even need that. The case law says there will be a presumption that it was intended to modify unless there's some kind of information in the record of a contrary intent. And there's no such information in the record. And none has been brought forth in the response by the real party in interest in their response to the writ of mandamus.
You modify something that isn't before you any longer, to wit, it's dismissed without first reinstating it?
I believe, Judge, you can modify, reform a judgment to reflect the intent of the court, and the intent of the court was, I think the record shows a clear intent, and it shows to me most likely that what happened in this case was that the master signed an order of dismissal, and that's part of the record, that the judge signed off on the master's recommendation, probably not going behind the case file to look at the master's ruling, and forgetting or not aware that the case was still pending before the court, and then actually an order had been provided or submitted to the court for approval. And then 2 days later, recognizing the error, corrects the error, and signs off on the motion for enforcement, which, by the way, is signed off on by both parties. And so I do believe that you can amend something that has been dismissed because it's about what the intent of the court was as far as keeping the pleadings alive. And obviously it was the court's intent to provide relief from the motion even after the order was signed dismissing the case.
I guess I have the same question that Judge McCoy did, or a similar one, in wondering whether under Check versus Mitchell and the case is saying you can have a second judgment and you presume that it sets aside the first, does it make a difference that this was a dismissal, and did there need to be a motion to reinstate before the court could reinstate and then modify?
Well, Your Honor, I will say this, that there are no cases exactly on point to this case that give us some guidance on that. We do know this, that the Middleton versus Murph case says it doesn't matter. The Middleton versus Murph case says it doesn't even matter if the order is void or not, It wasn't challenged timely. Therefore, that order is still going to be viable and in effect. And the Middleton versus Morph case, the court in the opinion went on to say, we've reinstated and directed the court trial courts on many occasions to implement void orders because they weren't challenged properly. And that's the case in this case. So even if I don't think it matters how it gets there, if there's a final order and it's not properly challenged in the time allotted by the statutes and by the case law, then that order is going to prevail. And so I don't think that that's really a viable issue, and I wish I had the answer to your question. I don't know the answer to the question because there's no case law that gives us an exact answer on point.
But really, does any of this, I mean, it seems like that the bottom line is there was an acceptance of benefits of under the judgment. And the law is pretty well settled that even if everything is absolutely done timely, if a party accepts the benefits of a judgment, they're stopped from further challenging it.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is our last contention, is that the real party interest in this case accepted benefits for 9 years. And it not only accepted benefits, but filed motions to modify to increase those benefits and made pleadings in the district court wanting the court to say, this is the order that needs to be modified, and this is the order we're relying upon.
Was the order increasing the benefits ever entered in response to that motion?
In response to that motion, Your Honor, and this is not part of the record, but I do have knowledge of the fact that there was an agreement on the modification subsequent to the motion to increase. There wasn't an agreement between the parties, and that's been settled. So there, as of this date, and I think I put this in the brief, the relator in this case is current on all arrearages per the July 28, 1999 order. And the children are already grown. And
another, the effect of voiding this order would be what?
Disaster. And the reason for that is, Your Honor, I say that because subsequent to this order being entered, a supplemental order was entered which, on the second child, terminated my client's rights because he was not the biological father. And that child was adopted by a step-parent. So to go back to prior to July 28, 1999 would mean that my client would be responsible for paying child support for a child that's not his.
That was adopted by someone else.
Correct, Your Honor. And plus, the other effect is the monetary amount, the change in the amount of money that he would owe, I believe it's been calculated by the Attorney General's office, is somewhere between $50,000 to $75,000 additional funds. And again, I think equity would show that this would not be fair to Mr. Fry because the order was signed off on by the real party in interest. It just makes no sense to do what's being asked to be done by the real party in interest in this case.
Is the difference in the amount because of the second child being included?
That's part of the reason, Your Honor, and it's also. Part of the reason, I think, is the way the interest was being computed under the 1999 order versus the order prior. So there's a difference in the way the interest was going to be calculated and computed, and all told, it made a significant difference on what this man is going to owe. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Becker, are you going to argue next?
May it please the court. I'm Michael Becker. I represent the Office of the Attorney General. We are a real party in interest in this case, but we're more aligned on one issue with the relator, Mr. Fry. This mandamus has arisen out of an enforcement action brought in by the Attorney General, in which we've been a longstanding party in this. It's a Title 4D case, a child support case. We've been providing child support services in it. We have an interest in knowing which is the controlling order, which is the valid order, but we would also like that answer to be correct, the correct answer under the law. And we agree with Mr. Fry that the second 1999 order, the one actually enforcing and modifying child support, is the valid judgment. It was signed within the court's plenary power after the dismissal for want of prosecution. Under the clear language of Rule 329BH, under the holding of Check v. Mitchell, we think that resulted in a modified judgment that is valid and controlling. We see nothing in the record to indicate that that was signed merely to extend the appellate timetable. So the only exception under Mackey that would change that rule from Check that's been followed in Owens Corning and the other case that that Mr. Fry's counsel mentions. Mackey's the only exception for that. There's nothing in the record that it was signed for that sole purpose. So we believe that the second 1999 order is the valid one and the one that should be enforced. That does result in a significantly lower arrearage amount in this case, but we think that's the correct answer under the law. I think there's an issue of mandamus relief being appropriate in this case because the order that's now being challenged was signed well after plenary power has expired over the valid 1999 order. And there's two Supreme Court cases, fairly recent cases, Southwestern Bell and Brookshire Brothers Groceries, that tells you if an order does that outside of plenary, it's a void order, subject to mandamus relief, and there's not a need to show an inadequate appellate remedy. So we think Mr. Fry is well-founded in his request for mandamus relief, and we don't oppose that. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to address those. If not, I'll give the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Mr. Kaitzer?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Excuse me. First of all, this is not the first time that this case has been before this court. Earlier, the real party in interest over here, the petitioner, Mr. Runge's client, Mr. Fry, had filed an action with this court that was dismissed for want of jurisdiction by the panel, which included also, I believe, Judge Casey and Judge Walker and Judge McCoy, because this court did not have jurisdiction over that appeal because Judge Harris's order was not a final appealable order. And from that perspective, I don't want to spend much time talking about that right now, but Judge, this case has not been finalized. There is no final appealable order, and I think that under applicable law that Judge Harris's ruling in this case is not so arbitrary or capricious or outside of his discretion that Mr. Fry cannot wait until there is a final appealable order to make an appeal of this court. We think he has an adequate remedy under law and that mandamus will not lie here. However, that being said, I want to spend a little bit of time on the issue of the fact that this case was dismissed for want of prosecution under Rule 165A. And I think Justice McCoy and Justice Gardner hit the nail right on the head when they said, when they made the observation, this is a little bit different than a normal sort of a case where the judge makes a ruling or an order and then retains plenary power under 329B. Rule 165A deals with dismissals for want of prosecution. And basically, when a case is dismissed for want of prosecution, it is over. There is no case pending before it. The court doesn't have jurisdiction to issue other orders because it has no case pending. The case is dismissed. and there are specific rules on how that is to be reinstated. And those rules are couched under 165A in terms of shall. If a case is dismissed for want of prosecution, a person or a litigant who wants to get that case reinstated is required to follow the procedures under Rule 165A3 and file a motion for reinstatement and get that set and get it heard and have the required proof, which isn't really a high standard to make that required proof. But nevertheless, that is what the court requires. I'm sorry, that is what the rules require. So that wasn't done here in this case.
But be that as it may, how do you respond to the acceptance of benefits argument? I mean, even if everything you say is exactly correct, when a party has accepted benefits under a judgment, the law is there to stop from accepting the benefits and also challenging it.
I understand. My response to that is the following. First of all, if you have a void judgment, I'm not sure that estoppel would work on that. And secondly, with respect to the issue of child support, it has always been an exception to the rules, I believe, the rule that you're quoting, Justice Walker, about acceptance of benefits, that when a party is dealing with something that they have a necessity to have, that is to say, child support, that acceptance, receipt of those payments of child support are a distinguishing factor in a person not being deemed to have accepted benefits under a judgment. There's cases, divorce cases in particular, that deal with the issue of property. If a person can show that that person had to have property in order to live, well, then they can be deemed not to have accepted the benefits of a judgment for purposes of being stopped from accepting those benefits. Similarly, in this case, there is no more, let me rephrase that, there are few more serious obligations imposed by the state than payment of child support. It is a matter of law. Mr. Fry must pay child support. If that rule were to be applied to Ms. Kaler, she would then be in the position of being required to send the money back. That can't be right because the money is for the benefit of the child. And so, therefore, I think that that exception would apply in this case here.
Of course, here, not only did she accept the benefits, she agreed to it. And to me, that just waves the estoppel flag back and forth several times. She agrees to it, and she accepts it, and now she doesn't like it. Well, 9 years later, at some point, it seems to me, there's got to be a... If something's not right here, you need to go ahead and bring it, not wait 9 years or 35 years. You know, is there no time period? Or is that not a factor?
Well, in this particular case, because the order on which part of the problem in this case is, it requires us to try to figure out what went on 10 years ago. And this happened 10 years ago, and there's...
That's not Mr. Fry's doing, that we have to go back 10 years and try to figure out what's going on, right?
Well, a motion to collect child support was filed in this case in 2008, and that's what brings us here today. And what happened was when that was presented to the associate judge, Judge Blaze, the 4D associate judge, he made the determination that that order was void. As far as he was concerned, this was brought by the Attorney General's office originally, I believe, in 2008 is the first instance that we have of anything actually going forward in Tarrant County on the issue of child support. So from that perspective, I don't think that that was what Ms. Kaler was trying to advocate at the time. But as a matter of law, Judge Blaze and then Judge Harris both found that the order was void for purposes of how they're going to handle the case on enforcement. But once again, none of this is a final order. Moreover, I think Mr. Runge in his statements talked about it was his impression that child support was paid up. Well, that's really quite inaccurate. It's not in the record, but he owes $50,000 under their theory and about $110,000 under our theory, and that is a significant difference. Moreover, The judgment that was signed, the second judgment, doesn't necessarily benefit Ms. Kaler. It provides in it a provision that says there'll be no more interest on child support after a particular date in 2001. In looking at that, I'm not sure that the court had the authority to make such a ruling or such a judgment that interest is cut off, because as a matter of law, that interest should still go forward because it is interest on child support. We deal in a funny area here because of the legal fictions in which we engage due to federal mandates. We have the Office of the Attorney General bringing actions, and that's how all of this becomes in place. And we have a situation where, as we see what the order says, who represents whom? Well, the order recites that the Office of the Attorney General represented Stacey Kaler. Well, no, not really. It doesn't represent Stacey Kaler. The AG's office is now more careful on how they do that. I'm not sure how that order got signed by Judge Miller some 6 days after the associate judge had dismissed it and 2 days after the presiding judge had adopted the associate judge's report and dismissed the case. I suspect that there was some lack of diligence on someone's part, and the order was probably up there and didn't get signed or whatever. Can the
trial court reinstate a case on its own motion?
If it is dismissed under 165A, I don't think so.
Was it dismissed under 165A?
It was dismissed for want of prosecution, is what the order says.
Well, from your recitation of facts, it kind of sounds like to me, if we're supposing what happened was that the case was dismissed for want of prosecution, the parties then reached an agreement and the court entered the order to which the parties agreed. So then we went forward. This guy went forward doing what the order said for 9 years, to which he had agreed and she'd agreed. Now we want to go back, say, oh, sorry.
Well, the order of dismissal was never set aside.
I understand.
Based upon how things work in family law sometimes and the way the dynamics of how those cases are, I don't think that that was how it happened in this case. I think that what happened is maybe the order was sitting on someone's desk and no one paid any attention to it. There was no motion filed. I don't think that the parties had the parties paid attention to that which should have been paid attention to, that is to say the order of dismissal for want of prosecution, they would have filed the motion to reinstate under Rule 165A. They did not do that in this case. The court just asked